The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The end of the road for Wales, falling like a Tour de France peloton, hit by a piece of cardboard, slipping away like a naughty health secretary hiding in a stationary cupboard. Their heaviest defeat in 9 years, and the Danes' first victory in a knockout stage for 23. Kasper Dolberg, one of the stars, along with a brilliant performance from Andreas Christensen once he was moved into midfield. We'll hear from Ben Fischer in Amsterdam and get an Ellis James cameo. Also tonight, Italy and Austria show how lopsided the draw is. One of eight very average teams are going to play England in the final, but a moment of joy from Federico Chiesa helps the Azzurri see off a very spirited Austria, and how great to see Gianluca Vialli so happy about all of it. Also tonight, some baby-based email correspondence, your questions, of course, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Lars Sivertsen, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hello.
And hello, Ed Ahrens.
Hi, Max.
First off, a full-time whistle just blown then in Amsterdam. Ben Fischer joins us. How was that, Ben?
Yeah, obviously a very disappointing way to bow out for Wales. Lots of glum faces in the final whistle. And I can't help but feel after such a strong start, such a kind of convincing start, particularly Gareth Bale was, you know, looking really in the mood, just how it got away from Wales. Yeah, I'm sure they'll look back on that and really kick themselves, because for that first 20, 25 minutes, they looked really in the groove.
So, look, you've had to travel with them. I know you haven't had to play a game. I don't know if you're knackered, but Wales looked knackered tonight.
I think only Switzerland and Sweden have travelled further than Wales at this tournament. You know, it's a bonkers amount of travelling they've had to do. And they've coped really well. I mean, it's just after the second goal this evening, they just took not the stuffing out of it. You know, 3 minutes into the second half, it was game over then. And yeah, in terms of myself, it's definitely catching up with me. As I was filing my reports on the whistle, I was getting emails flooding in saying cancellation for hotel and flights to Baku on Monday. So there's a trip that won't be happening.
I mean, you could still go. Why not? You know, enjoy yourself. Why not get some anecdotes out of it? We should mention the atmosphere. And obviously, you know, Denmark, everyone's sort of favourite second team, if not first team now in the tournament. What was the atmosphere like?
Yeah, amazing. And, you know, who can really sort of not want the Danes to have a good time after the last couple of weeks? You know, players, staff and fans. I mean, hell of an occasion here. I think only 5,000 supporters that the Danish FA, I think, said had got tickets for this, but it feels substantially more than that here. And you can probably hear it now as I'm talking to you. You know, they're really lapping it up. And what a story for the Danes. I mean, to be in the quarterfinals, and you have to say probably, you know, with a strong chance of maybe advancing to the semis is hell of an achievement.
Charlie says, how did Ben find the parking at the Johan Cruyff Arena?
My journey was smooth. I was here stupidly early, probably the earliest I've ever been for a game to avoid all issues. I was here about 5 hours before kickoff. So I can certainly say I soaked up the fanfare.
Well, listen, thanks for coming on. Ben, as a sort of flat performance from Wales, we'll get into the analysis with the panellists in the pod. Safe trip home, and you know, I hope you get some time off, or we'll get you on a normal pod when you're not at a ground yelling at us.
Cheers, take care.
Ben Fischer there, out in Amsterdam. Kieran says, has anyone checked on Ellis James just to make sure he isn't burning Lego in the street? This was Ellis's Twitter thread. Well, that's me done with Bacon, Carlsberg and bleak crime drama. A few minutes later, our boys don't seem to realise that the success of my career is directly related to their performances on the pitch. A few seconds later, parental advisory, Lego can fuck off as well. Just in, a voice note from Ellis James for the Football Weekly audience.
Oh, well, our European adventures come to an end. I don't think we've conceded four since we lost 6-1 to Serbia in 2012. I missed a bit. I haven't checked this very thoroughly, but I can't remember another time when we've conceded four. Denmark were clearly the better side. Congratulations to them. I thought there were some very, very questionable refereeing decisions. Harry Wilson's red card, Kiefer Moore seemingly being booked for being tall. But I don't want this to sound like sour grapes. We got out of the blocks pretty quickly, actually. And I thought, oh, this reminds me of Turkey. But then after a good 20 minutes, they settled in. And the game at that stage was reminiscent of when we played them in the Nations League in 2018. We lost 2-0 out in Aarhus, then we lost 2-1 in Cardiff. And they are a good side. And we seem to run out of ideas when we play Denmark. Tomorrow, I will probably be very, very proud of the team and pleased with the fact that we got out of the group. The last 16 was my ambition at the start of the tournament. And I think it's an achievement. I think it's an achievement, especially when you consider that, you know, the stuff that's been thrown at us. We have a caretaker interim manager because of Ryan Giggs's court case. The FAW doesn't have a chief executive. We've had to travel thousands of miles without any of our fans being allowed in the ground. You know, there were thousands of Danish there today. It seemed to be a couple of hundred at most Welsh fans. And strictly speaking, they're not allowed to be there. And I feel cheated in that regard because, you know, I didn't get to go to any of these games. But that is something for another time. Anyway, loved Gareth Bale walking off in disgust with his interview at the end. That was quite good fun. Other than that, though, struggling to find positives, but I'm sure I'll feel differently in the morning. Anyway, Max, I don't know who else is on the panel, but I love you all. Peace out.
There is Ellis James finishing quite a sad message about Wales going out. Barry, I mean, I think Ellis was probably right, and I think we will all agree Wales were not the best team on the football pitch during this football match.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that for a man who was really trying not to make that sound like sour grapes, he failed dismally. But with regard to the game, yeah, he pretty much summed it up in a nutshell. Denmark started well, then Wales got on top of them after 3 or 4 minutes. And after, I don't know, 12 or 15 minutes with Gareth Bale threatening to run amok, the Danish coach, Kasper Hjulmand, changed his formation, went from 3 at the back to 4, moved Andreas Christensen sort of into a holding role, and that seemed to... I'm not sure quite how, because I'm not a tactical guru like Emma Hayes or Jonathan Wilson, but that seemed to completely nullify the threat of Bale and Aaron Ramsey. I suppose they couldn't find those pockets of space they like running into. And from then on, it was men against boys. It was, in so much as Wales put in an almost totally complete performance against Turkey, they were comparatively awful here and thoroughly deserved to lose.
Lars, can you explain that tactical change? Because it did make such a difference. And I mean, from my point of view, Christensen... It is a different role, completely different role on the pitch holding midfield to centre back, and he did it so well. But why did that change everything?
Yeah, I'm not listeners will be aware I'm also not Emma Hayes, and in fact nor am I Wilson, but basically there were times where it looked like Christensen was almost man marking Aaron Ramsey and just making sure he couldn't receive the ball and play it on or play it into wide areas, and that really stifled Wales' threat. I think also just by dropping the fullbacks a little bit deeper out of possession, certainly that meant there was less space for Dan James and Bale to run into, because that was my big thing before the game. When you play with a back three and pretty attacking wingbacks, as Denmark had done in the last two games, there is that sort of awkward bit of space between the wide centre half and the wing back, where there is room to sort of a space to roam for a Dan James or a Gareth Bale. And we saw that Wales kind of target those areas early on in the game. I even WhatsApped you, Max, and I was like, "Ha ha, I was right. They are going to threaten those parts of the pitch because we were talking about it earlier." And then Ullmann just changed it, and by having the fullbacks a little bit deeper, they were still getting forward in possession, but out of possession, they were a bit deeper. And Christensen just sticking to Ramsey so he couldn't connect to those attacking players. It seemed to nullify Wales entirely. And that was the interesting thing, just to add a bit of background there, is that when Ullmann was brought in to take over after Åge Hareide, one of the worries some people in Denmark had was that Ullmann was too much of a dreamer. You know, he's someone who likes Cruyff and Guardiola and this sort of thing, whereas he was replacing the very pragmatic Åge Hareide, and they were worried that he didn't have the sort of, I'm going to use the word again, pragmatic edge to make these sort of adjustments in international football. And so I think not only has he sort of proved himself to be a great leader in this tournament and managed the sort of tonal challenges of leading the team in the aftermath of what happened with Christian Eriksen, that little sort of canny tactical move there, I think, will have shut up quite a few critics or at least alleviated some suspicions about his ability to do this sort of thing.
I was writing, Ed, sort of just taking notes during the game, and about sort of 15 minutes in, I wrote, you know, Yusuf Poulsen is a big loss for Denmark. And about a second later, Kasper Dolberg, his replacement, bent one in the corner from 20 yards. And you wrote a piece about him in May 2017, and it has taken over 4 years, but now we are all interested in this article.
Well, yeah, that's why I just remember that I saw that he was named in the starting lineup. So I'm actually a big fan of Poulsen, who's a kind of classic non-scoring striker, isn't he, normally? But very, very useful for Denmark. But yeah, Dolberg has kind of was shot onto the scene. You know, there's been lots of Danish players who've gone through the Ajax system. Obviously, Eriksen, very famously. But going way back as well, people like Jan Molby were there. And there's a long-standing link between Ajax and Denmark. So Dolberg was one of these guys who was tipped to be, well, the article it was all about, it was an interview with his agent, basically. So, you know, he was bigging him up, saying that the next Van Basten, which actually I think that the next Van Basten tag came from his father, I think, who was obviously bigging his own son up as well. And a bit of background, I think Dolberg's parents were both handball players. And he also grew up in a very sporting environment and did really well at Ajax. People probably remember him that season, the Europa League, when Ajax got to the final and lost to United. It's not to say that it's gone wrong for him, really, because, you know, he had a massive move to Nice. They spent a lot of money on him, over 20 million euros. He had been linked to Man City, actually, that summer, I think I wrote in that article. I think he's had a few injuries. And as Lars was saying in the group as well, you know, he's had COVID twice this year. He's had his watch stolen by his teammate. And it's not been an easy ride. But you could see that. I mean, I absolutely loved that finish for the first goal. And it, you know, just was like an arrow, wasn't it, into the corner. No chance for the keeper, Danny Ward. And yeah, he just showed what he was all about. And then the second goal was just, you know, he was in the right place at the right time. That poor clearance, and he made that mistake there. So, but he looks like a real star of the future. If he can, you know, play like that and finish like that for Denmark, then they'll fancy their chances in the next round.
I also look forward to reading your incisive interviews from this year in 2025. Michael says, does any of the panel know if Robbie Savage thought there was a foul in the build-up to the second Denmark goal? Dale Johnson, you know, VAR King, said the kind of decision that would be given as a foul by VAR in the Bundesliga, but considered too far back in the move by UEFA or the Premier League. I thought it was a foul, Barry. I could see why the Wales players were slightly disappointed, even though, you know, they had a bit of time to get back into position before the goal was scored.
I thought it was a foul, Simon Kjær on Kiefer Moore. And then there was a VAR check after the goal, but that was to check whether a subsequent pass to Martin Braithwaite on the touchline had gone out of play or not. And it hadn't. But look, Wales had plenty of time to regroup and the defending was shocking. So, you know, they were well beaten, so any complaints are a little bit mealy-mouthed, I think.
And I mean, we did make a point of this earlier in the tournament where everyone was saying, oh, it's so great, VAR not getting involved as often. We did say on this pod, like, yeah, when you're watching two teams you don't really care about, less VAR is good, but there might come a time where a team you do care about is involved with a situation that a stricter, sort of more hyperactive VAR might have caught. And this sort of non-involvement thing is maybe not so fun then. And I think we had that moment today. Though I will say that the red card was a bit of a nonsense.
Yeah, I was just about to say, if Antonio Rudiger, like, touches Harry Kane 20 minutes before Germany score on Tuesday night, I will be wanting them to go all the way back to that moment. The red card was interesting, wasn't it? I mean, I like Joe Roden literally saying to the referee, you've been terrible, sort of on repeat to his face. Matthew says the Wilson challenge was pretty innocuous, but I'd like to see more red cards for those kind of fouls to get them out of the game. Kicking an opponent with no attempt to get the ball seems pretty straightforward. Ed, I don't know what you think.
Well, just going back to the Moore one, I think that's been a bit of a feature of the tournament as well that I've liked, is that the referees have tried to play on in these sort of 50-50 challenges where often, you know, especially in the Champions League, maybe, I think, fouls are given when, you know, and that frustrates a lot of fans, I think, when it's a cheap foul is given away when it isn't. But in this case, you know, I think it was a foul. It was, you know, he took him out. Although Moore was looking for the contact, looking for the foul, Kier, you know, obliged, didn't he, and took him out, really. So, I think, you know, that really was a turning point in the game. 1-0 down at that stage, weren't they? And I can understand why Bale was so upset. And then the red card, you know, any chance they had of coming back was gone with that, wasn't it, I think?
The third goal was Marlon, really well taken. This is not a player I know a huge amount about. Can you tell us about him? Because he also played that lovely threaded pass for the first goal too.
Yeah, he plays as a wing back for Atalanta. And Atalanta, yet again, their scouting department scoring a win there, I think we can say. They signed him for, I think, about 10 million euros from Genk in January, which, I mean, I think if he was still playing in Belgium and someone wanted to sign him after this tournament, the price tag would be very, very different. And Atalanta are so good at this, at finding, you know, top potential, top level performers, and sometimes in sort of in leagues where you don't always look for them. So very, very good by them. And yeah, very good attacking wing back who's been really good in this tournament. Very exciting, gets forward really well.
Jason says, is this the last we'll see of Gareth Bale on the international scene? He walked off post-match when asked about whether this would be his last game. Alex says, after Gareth Bale walked out on his post-match interview, has Max ever asked any of you a question that's caused you to walk out? No, but Barry, frequently I ask you what I think is a question and you look at me like I'm completely brain dead and said, that's not a question. Is this your last pod or are you planning to carry on after the tournament?
Well, sadly, unlike Gareth Bale, I don't have bazillions of pounds to fall back on if I do happen to walk out in the face of your inane questioning. But I don't know if he'll retire. I mean, playing for Wales seems to be the only football he actively enjoys. So I would find it a strange decision, but he strikes me as the type of fella who could quite happily do without football or has maybe had enough. So I don't know. It would be interesting to see. I mean, I presume that BBC reporter will be getting it in the neck from the hordes on Twitter for daring to ask him the question. But, you know, it's a question that had to be asked. And Bale was perfectly entitled to not answer it as well.
Yeah, he did say, Ed, that, you know, it would be chaos if he said what he would do. So I'm intrigued to know what this chaos might be. Part of me thinks he might just play for Wales.
It's crossed my mind that he said it would be chaos when he announced what he was going to do, and maybe what he was going to do isn't actually that interesting, and now he's afraid to announce what he's going to do in case it's not chaotic enough.
Rob says, if it came to Denmark v Sweden, who's Lars rooting for?
I saw this question. This is really difficult. I think it probably is Denmark, but for me, but probably for no other reason than the whole thing, this tournament and everything. I you know, I'm equally friendly towards my Nordic neighbors, to be honest. It would be Finland, really, since I spent some time there, but I mean, they're gone, so.
Yes, that's not part of the choice. You don't get that choice. On references that no one else gets, you know, much like Frankie de Jong and Only the Young, I looked at Damsgaard and Dolberg. They're sort of quite emotionless, you know, characters. sort of ice cold. They reminded me slightly of those. Do you remember Barry in Minority Report? Those were they sort of twins who lay in the pool.
It's an interesting one for Damsgaard. Maybe not so much for Dolberg, but Dolberg looks a lot like one of the kids in The Hunger Games.
Okay.
Which I tweeted, and it turns out nobody remembers The Hunger Games, so, you know.
Oh, well. And if anyone wants to share that reference with me, I'd appreciate it. I think it is also worth mentioning, Ed, and, the news cycle moves on so quickly, and football moves on so quickly, and everything else moves on so quickly. It is not long ago that, Christian Eriksen had a cardiac arrest on the pitch with those players around him and that management team and those fans, and we should just remember what an how that will still be playing out for all of those players and the coaching staff as well.
Definitely. Well, it seems to have worked. I think the first game was maybe a bit too. The first game after it was a bit too soon, but it's definitely acting as inspiration for them now, and they've got momentum behind them. So they're in the quarterfinals now, and and they're going to be playing in Baku against the Netherlands or the Czech Republic. So I think, they've got a great chance of getting through that with all the momentum that they've gathered.
All right, that'll do for part one. We'll be back in just a second talking about Italy's 3-0 win over Austria. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Italy 2, Austria 1 after extra time. Ed, what did you make of that Italy performance?
Well, it was a bit surprising, wasn't it? I think everybody expected them just to, carry on where they left off in the group stages and really, brush Austria aside. But they struggled throughout. And I thought actually Austria missed a chance, actually. They looked like they were the team that were most likely to win it in the second half at the, sort of midway point. And they seemed to just sort of ease off towards the end and were happy to play for the extra time and maybe penalties eventually. That was what they were hoping for. And then, it came back to bite them because Italy scored two good goals in extra time in the first half. And then Austria had to come out and play, and they did. They made a good effort of it, didn't they, to almost get back in. I love some of the long balls towards the end of just proper Sunday league where they're just launching it. But, Italy, I think, I wasn't that surprised because I think everybody, tipped them to do well. And often when you start so well, it's not as easy in the knockout stages, and going away from home as well, I think was a big factor. And one thing I noticed, the atmosphere was really quite flat, wasn't it? I think that's what we're going to see a bit with less home team advantage and teams travelling all over the place. It's maybe a few occasions like that where there's not so many fans of either team in the stadium.
Yeah, it did sound like a sort of Victory Shield match to me. It sounded like sort of under 15s, like there are lots of kids in the crowd, but no real. Sort of, in many ways, and I tweeted that out, it made me feel like almost the most I've missed fans in a stadium in this whole period of lockdown and pandemic. And I don't know if that is some recency bias affecting me. And I know there were fans there, but it just felt like this should have been more. It should have been more of an occasion.
I mean, it can be hard to judge because I wasn't quite as fortunate as some others. I wasn't in the stadium. I was watching it at home. But through the TV, it did have kind of the vibe of one of the sort of early cup rounds Tottenham played there when they were in Wembley for a bit. They moved some of the cup rounds, but they played a couple. And I was at one of those, and one of those where you sort of, you put the ticket prices right down and maybe given away some tickets to schools and just try to get people in because it's a midweek Carabao Cup game against someone. And people are happy to be there and there will be some singing and clapping, but it's not something we will recognize as a proper football atmosphere. And I don't necessarily think that affected the game as such. And I just thought Italy were fine in the first half. In the first half, I felt it was more of, them looking more coherent and more cohesive than a lot of other national teams do. But it was remarkable the way it dropped off in the second half. But I wonder if maybe the reality of the situation started setting in a little bit. The reality of the fact that they are just at this point one long thump to Arnautovic away from this all going terribly wrong for them, and some of the old sort of Italian football instincts that they still must have in their spines somewhere started kicking in. I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, I do. I think I've said before that the innate Italianness of this, hitherto swashbuckling Italian team would bubble to the surface at some point, and I think it did in that second half. I thought they were kind of lucky to hang on for extra time. I saw people on Twitter saying the first half was quite entertaining, and Gary Lineker said it was very entertaining. I was bored out of my skull.
Yeah, I'm with you.
More so in the second half. But at least, you know, Austria, it looked like Austria might actually win. And then Arnautovic had the goal ruled out for offside, which, you know, was a good goal, but he was offside. Stuart Atwell eventually ruled it out. And, yeah, it looked all over in extra time when Italy scored their two good goals. But Sasha Kaladzic, I thought his goal was terrific, that header, you know, just on the floor and snuck in at the near post. But ultimately, Austria came up a little short.
I thought, Ed, the Chiesa goal was really beautifully taken. Some people tweeting us saying, you know, reminded them of Bergkamp versus Argentina in 98. I'm saying, let's not get carried away here. Like, he took it well, but there are great goals and there are good goals.
Well, the best thing about it was the control with the face. I thought it was fantastic because it was really high up, wasn't it? And it could easily have just sort of, you know, nicked off his head and gone out. But he managed to keep it under control. And then the next touch was superb, just to, you know, get it into the right position to smash it into the net. And he's a great player. I was just remarking, he's only 23, but he looks a lot older, doesn't he? He's got quite an old face. I mean, I don't know if that's good when you're in front of goal or not, but yeah, it's fantastic.
It's not good for Dwight Gale, is it?
No. Whoa. I don't know. He was an ace goal scorer, but yeah, he has a very old face as well. I agree. But no, I mean, Chiesa, I was surprised, to be honest, that he hasn't been, you know, starting in this tournament. And also the selection for the team, that Locatelli wasn't playing. I was surprised that he wasn't in the starting lineup. And obviously, Verratti's great, but he's struggling to get him in the side, I think, a little bit. And they looked, well, maybe, obviously, in extra time, they looked a lot better with the two goals.
It's an interesting one, that, because I think this is the midfield three that he would have preferred going into the tournament. But then, because Verratti was unavailable, as he always is occasionally, Locatelli came in and did a lot better than I think anyone was expecting. With Berardi, yeah, it's a tight one between those two, but he played kind of well in the group stages. I do, lastly, on Kaladzic, the header, which is remarkable. First of all, it's a really good header and how he managed to get that in, but also seeing a player who's basically 5 meters tall score a header that was from all the way down there, it was kind of strange.
I don't know if I've got any more questions about this game, Barry. I didn't think it was very good.
Well, there was one thing I'd like to pull you up on, Max. I saw you tweet during the game that Arnautovic was a brilliant player. Were you being sarcastic?
No, I thought he had a great game. I thought he led the line. I think it's a lonely job leading the line. I thought he did it really well. You know, I thought he took that chance incredibly well. And there were times, you know, there was one run that he did so well and he should have laid it off and he had a shot that went out for a throw-in. But I just think in those games where you have so little of the ball and it is so difficult because you get it once every sort of 15 minutes and then there's so much pressure on you to A, hold it up, give your defenders a breather, B, try and make a chance. I thought he was really impressive in that game. I'm happy to be outvoted. Clearly, I don't really mind.
I thought he played okay. I just, in general, I think he's an awful character.
Yeah, I think that's the thing about him. He's good when he can be good when he wants to be, but it's just not enough. It's not consistent enough. But you know, the header with his disallowed was a great finish, wasn't it? It was unfortunate. He was just half a body offside.
I think with him is just the immense frustration you feel when you look at a player who obviously has that amount of physical power in his body that he has, and he's quite quick for a guy that size, and his touch is great, and he can finish. And you just wonder, how on earth have you had the career that you've had and not something, you know, quite a lot better? I'm sure he's had a good time and made money, and I'm sure he's grand and doesn't regret his choices and all of that, but really, there is a guy who should have achieved a lot more, surely.
Yeah, I mean, I just thought Austria's good players turned up. I thought he did. I thought Sabitzer did. I thought Alaba is sort of, you know, to have such an influence on a game from left back is sort of quite impressive. And I don't know how many Italians came out of that game with a lot of credit. I mean, they dug in, but
Spinazzola was very good down the left wing. Him and was it Insigne linked up well and. Especially in the first half, but it was a you know, ultimately a dogged Italian performance from Italy.
But I think when Italy got themselves in this situation, that it was 0-0, it was getting a bit fraught, Austria had a goal disallowed, they had chances. All that being what it was, I thought it was a victory for them, for the squad, for the fact that you can bring someone off the bench who can change the game. Chiesa scoring, Pessina scoring, Locatelli coming back and being good in midfield. You know, Belotti putting in a shift, as I believe the phrase is, up front, winning free kicks and bumping into people. They've made a big deal in Italy about how it's about the squad, it's about the squad. In the group stage, it kind of wasn't. It was a little bit more about the 11. And here we saw those guys come in and make a big difference in a situation that had gone out of control a little bit.
Ed, lovely to see Gianluca Vialli just being so delighted about things. I didn't even know he was part of the Italian coaching setup, I'll be honest.
Well, no, I was going to say he's not, is he? No, he's just there on a day. No, he is. I think he's the assistant, isn't he? But I was just thinking, what's...
Is he like Sammy? He's like the Sammy Lee of Italy, just there to applaud.
No, he's kind of the honorary president of their travelling parties. Right. Basically the regimental goat.
Well, he's got a great sort of moustache beard going on, hasn't he? I noticed it's kind of a two-tone, handlebar moustache and going into a beard. It was... great. And he got so excited with both goals, didn't he? He ran down and embraced him. But yeah, he was a pretty good manager, wasn't he, for a brief time, a long time ago at Chelsea. Yeah.
There was also one brilliantly Italian moment where Austria got a free kick on the edge of the box and every Italian player was around Anthony Taylor with just like both hands clasped together, sort of, you know, like... They weren't quite saying Mamma Mia, but it was sort of like that. They were all just around him just going, you can't have given this free kick away. Anyway, Italy are through and they will play the winners of Portugal and Belgium, which is that game itself is exciting. And then that quarterfinal is also exciting. But I imagine both Belgium and Portugal watching that game thinking, well, if they do that again, then we've got a good chance. Did anyone think the pitch at Wembley looks quite slow? Like, the ball doesn't zip around, or am I just getting nervous about Tuesday night and making excuses already?
I can't say I did notice, but what is indisputable is that the games, until extra time in this game, I think three or four games played at Wembley in this tournament had only served up two goals. So make of that what you will, I don't know.
I think the ball not zipping around is probably good for England, more so than bad for England, Aunt Max. I would
dare you. you're right. All right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll briefly look ahead to tomorrow's games, or today's games, if you're listening on Sunday, which you almost certainly are. There's no way you could be listening on Saturday. And we'll do some emails and some questions too. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Tomorrow we've got the Netherlands, Czech Republic and Belgium, Portugal. Barry, how do you see the Netherlands, Czech Republic? Can you see the Czechs doing what the Austrians did today?
Yeah. I don't think they'll win, but I think they're better than Austria and I think they could well give the Netherlands a run for the money. I think Thomas Suchek still has to score a goal. He is going to score in this tournament, no question, from a corner with a header. So maybe he'll get his goal tomorrow. But yeah, I would imagine the Netherlands will win.
Ed, do you go along with that?
I mean, they're obviously the favourites and they've been very impressive in the group stage. But, you know, there's definitely some big weaknesses in the Dutch team. And, you know, Frank de Boer's done well so far in this tournament, but there's a lot of scrutiny on him. Even though they did so well, I think there's a few people, I think Rafael van der Vaart said that they shouldn't even be on TV last week, even though because the formation that they're playing. Frank de Boer's twin brother Ronald said before the tournament that Cruyff would be turning in his grave if he could see with the formation that he's playing. But I mean, it's really working very well. And, one of my favourite players of the tournament, Denzel Dumfries, has been absolutely amazing right wing back. And so it's clearly working for them at the moment. But yeah, there's a big question mark about them in terms of how far they can go. And obviously, they're not at home anymore. So that's going to be a big factor.
Do the De Boers not get along?
They do. I think he caveated it by saying, I should say that he said it was the same under Ronald Koeman when he was the Dutch coach as well, that, you know, it's just the formation. They don't like that formation. It's got to be this 4-3-3 or nothing, isn't it, in the Netherlands. So
I suppose, in the Netherlands, you know, your loyalties are Johan Cruyff, then your family. I presume that's just for everybody, isn't it?
4-3-3, yeah. Johan Cruyff, then, yeah, your family.
I'm very tickled by this idea that maybe it could be Rafa van der Vaart who's behind this plane banners who keep going over the training ground. Like maybe we've got van der Vaart zooming about in a Cessna, you know, sending messages to the squad.
He'd look quite good with the Biggles goggles. And
yeah.
That sort of leather
for
cap.
Sure. He is a man of hidden talents. He's very good at the darts. Why not a pilot, you know?
Belgium, Portugal, on paper, yeah, one of the two most exciting games in this last 16, Baz, would you say? Along with England, Germany. Maybe I'm being biased with that one.
I am looking forward to it immensely. I've decided I think Portugal will win. I'm not sure why, but I don't really care who wins, but I just hope it's a thriller of a game. And I think it very well might be.
Yeah, it could be, Lars.
No, I'm just enjoying Baz's approach to this because I've been really agonising. Because we're always meant to, like, who will win? What is your prediction? What do you think? I have no idea. This is a complete 50-50, this. I mean, I have no idea at the best of times, let's face it. But like, I certainly have no idea here. I am intrigued to see Belgium's defence being tested a bit more. You know, their record in qualifying was extraordinary, like averaging 4 goals a game. They've hardly ever lost recently, you know, top of the FIFA rankings and all this. If you go through the games they play, they haven't faced a lot of very strong opposition. And obviously, Portugal do have some handy forwards. And I'm also really intrigued to see how Portugal line up. I mean, Nelson Semedo picked up a knock in the last game. Cancelo's already gone home because of COVID. Who is that right back? You know, suggestions that Diogo Dalot might start. I mean, that's not ideal, maybe. Will the midfield be the same as against France or the sort of very stodgy one we saw before that? A lot of questions before this. I think it's complete 50-50. But if I have to make a prediction, because apparently we have to, I'm going to go with Barry. I have a creeping suspicion based on absolutely nothing that Portugal's going to edge it.
Ed, are you going to be the sole voice for the Belgians? I think Belgium will probably win this. So not the sole voice. Do you want to join Lars and Barry's team or do you want to join my team?
Oh, it's a tough one. It's a tough one. I mean, I think the reason that most people think that Portugal are going to get through is because it happened last time, didn't it? They came third in the group. And then, you know, they're a tournament team, as you say. But so you expect them to scrap their way through this maybe. But, you know, Belgium are the number one team in the world. I don't know whether that means much, but they should be the favourites, really, shouldn't they? Because they, you know, they came top of their group and are in good form. So they would probably take heart from the way that Germany ripped Portugal apart, won't they? They played quite a similar system, and they'll think, you know, if we can do the same as Germany did, then we can cause them a lot of problems. So I think, yeah. All right, let's. I'll just to equal it up. I'll say Belgium.
Okay, Barca Jim. Jim Burke, friend of the pod, of course. Who would Barry ideally want England to lose to? I say Germany, simply as I need it to happen quickly.
Sorry, I think I can hear gunshots out in my street. Just hold on, I'm going to go to the window to increase my chances of getting shot. Nah, it's all right, it's fireworks.
Okay, fair enough. Excellent.
Italian fans.
Probably Italian fans. But how brave of Barry. It was like the Kate Ady of Football Weekly there, going straight to the window to report live on the gunshots from his window. On to the emails that we've received. A couple of good ones. This one is from Natale, who says, Dear Max and the team, I've been a regular listener to your pod for several years. I'm currently thoroughly enjoying your coverage of the Euros. As would, it seems, does my 8-week-old son, Alessandro. Being so young, he has battled somewhat to enact regular and unprovoked bowel movements. However, I was spending some time with him yesterday while listening to you and the team dissect the England performance against the Czechs, and strange sounds started to emanate from deep inside the little guy. Suffice to say, Jackson Pollock would have been proud of what transpired. I can't tell exactly what triggered it, though quite possibly Barry's dulcet, sonorous tones. Either way, my wife Karina is especially grateful as we've been getting a little worried. In the future, should this problem persist, I'll just put Barry on repeat. Either way, keep up the good work. If only more football pundits were as eloquent and grounded in reality as you all are. This is...
Natale, of course, and hello to Alessandro as well. And it's good to know that if anyone's baby is slightly constipated, all you need to do is get Barry to talk, and he can recreate what happened to him on the live show. We're not actually on the live show, just to be clear about
this. I hope not. Good Lord.
Call me the colon whisperer.
And this is from Kyle, Lauren and Satori. Hi, Max, Barry and co. My son Satori was born on Friday the 11th of June, just a few hours before the Euros began. On Sunday, all three of us arrived home safely, just in time to watch England's opening game against Croatia. It occurred to me this morning, this is a few days ago, when listening to the most recent pod, that after three games, my son has never seen England lose a game of football. While I remain steadfast in my belief that this will be the summer football finally comes home, I was wondering whether Barry could offer any soothing words of comfort for Satori should England ever lose another football match. Love the pod. Keep up the great work, Kyle, Lauren and Satori.
Just enjoy it, Satori, like all right-thinking people.
And when England lose?
That's what I mean.
Oh, enjoy that.
Yeah.
Well, there's your message. I suppose if you do, you'll have a happier England-supporting lifetime than most of us. And look, that'll do for today's pod. Lars, thanks for your time.
Farewell, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Ed.
Thanks, Max.
We'll be back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.